Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, good friends. Good to see you again, and welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. Well, we are doubly blessed to welcome to today's podcast attorney Barbara McQuaid. Barbara's best known, of course, and where you see her most often, as a legal analyst on NBC News and MSNBC. She's also a professor of law at the University of Michigan and former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Now, why we're doubly blessed to have her with us today is first because of all the news coming out of the Supreme Court, and now that they've decided on the Colorado case and the 14th Amendment, all those questions about what they might do about their next big decision on presidential immunity. And second, because Barbara's just published a very important new book on disinformation, which is, perhaps, as she points out, the greatest threat facing our democracy today. In her book, Attack from Within, Barbara McQuaid not only spells out the danger of disinformation, but she lays out a detailed strategy for overcoming it. Yep, lots of big legal news these days, and nobody better to tackle it than our guest today. Barbara McQuaid, a big fan of yours for a long time. It's great to welcome you to the Bill Press Pod. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Bill. Thrilled to be here.
So, your book is so good, and it's so powerful, and so scary, I might add. I really want to jump into you with that, but first, we've got to talk about a little bit of breaking news.
Yeah.
Anything surprise you about the Supreme Court's decision that Colorado could not keep Donald Trump off the ballot?
Yeah, I would have been surprised except for the oral arguments that we heard just a couple of weeks ago, when it was really clear that almost all of the justices, and now we know all of the justices, were really skeptical of this idea that a single state could make a decision to keep a presidential candidate off the ballot. So I'm not surprised that this is the way they came out. There are a lot of moving parts here. And I know there are people sort of crying foul that, they're in the bag for Trump. I don't think so. I think, you know, they were looking for an off-ramp perhaps, and this was an off-ramp. But I don't think it's crazy or unreasonable to say that it's Congress who gets to decide how this section is implemented. There's lots of arguments you can make the other way, I think, but you know, this is the law of the land. Now we have clarity and we shall proceed forward.
On the other hand, we hear so much about the originalists who say we have to take the Constitution seriously.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you read the Constitution and the 14th Amendment, it's pretty clear that if you've participated in an insurrection, you cannot hold federal office.
Yeah,
they ignored that argument, didn't they?
I think what they are saying is, you know, we're not deciding whether Trump did or did not engage in an insurrection, but it's not courts who get to make this decision; it's Congress who gets to make this decision. So, in some ways, it's a little bit of a punt, but you know, it says that Congress is the one that gets to waive this disability if they want to, and so it seems not unreasonable to say that Congress is the body that gets to decide whether Donald Trump has engaged in insurrection. So it's still possible they could, I suppose, pass such enabling legislation. But I think in light of our polarized Congress, that's unlikely to happen.
Right. So maybe, I believe certainly, much more important is the pending decision of the Supreme Court on immunity. I have to ask you, first of all, if they've already helped Donald Trump to a certain extent by delaying taking up the case and delaying the decision, I guess. But, you know, it seems to me that if any other elected official in this country who had taken an oath to uphold the laws of the land and then were charged with a crime walked into the courtroom and said, no, I'm immune because I took, I'm whatever, attorney general, they'd be laughed out of court. Why did the Supreme Court even take this case?
Yes. Well, I don't know, because I think that what Jack Smith was hoping for was just an affirmation of what the D.C. Circuit Court did without any further argument, briefing, discussion, done, you know, right back to the trial court. But what they wrote in this question presented was whether and to what extent a president is immune for, and then they say, alleged official acts that a former president engaged in while president. And so I suppose they are taking this opportunity to draw some lines about what is and is not off limits, because, you know, there's this argument that Donald Trump has made that, well, if there is no immunity, then any successive president could charge his predecessor for anything he did while in office, such as dropping bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki with President Truman, or using drone strikes for President Obama. And so perhaps this is an opportunity to carve out and say, here are the types of acts that are protected, and here is the type of acts that are not. I would fully expect that the acts with which Donald Trump is accused would fall on the outside of that, of the unprotected, non-immune. But my only worry is that it's going to take a long time to get there, that they're going to brief this decision. They're handling it on an expedited basis, but I don't know whether it's expedited enough. And then there's the concern, are they going to require the court below to engage in fact-finding as to what is and is not an official act, and then appeal that? Because if that's the case, then there will not be a trial in 2024.
Right. Do you think, I've heard some legal experts say that the Supreme Court had no choice. They had to take this case.
Oh, I don't think that's right.
You agree?
No, I don't think so. I think they could have simply allowed the D.C. Circuit Court opinion to stand. They do that all the time in lots of other situations. So I don't think they had to take the case. I suppose one thing that may have prompted them to do that was even Jack Smith himself had argued back before the D.C. Circuit took up the case that the Supreme Court should leapfrog the D.C. Circuit Court, intermediate appellate court, go straight from the trial to the Supreme Court. And it was Jack Smith who also argued, because this case is of such supreme importance for the nation and to have these lines clarified and drawn. And so, you know, what we've got both sides arguing that. And so I suppose that may be what people are saying was the reason that the court felt compelled to take this case. I remain cautiously optimistic that it's possible for them to get a decision about this, you know, in May and get this trial back on track and completed before the election. I think it'll be about a 6 to 8 week trial. So if they can get started by, you know, late summer or early fall, I think there's still time for that, as long as there isn't any more, you know, intermediate appeal along the way.
Does the fact that the Supreme Court agreed to take this case tell us anything about how they might decide?
No, I don't think so. You know, sometimes there is a tell there. You know, for instance, when the court decided to take up the Dobbs case, abortion case overturned Roe, there would have been no reason to take that case up because the court below had simply followed Roe. And so unless they were thinking about overturning Roe, there would have been no reason to take that up. So that was a tell. I don't think there's a tell here. This is kind of uncharted territory. And I think the court may just want to be providing clarity that only the Supreme Court can provide as the highest court in the land about the outer boundaries of, you know, when a president is immune from prosecution for, you know, protected but controversial acts versus when he exceeds those boundaries and abuses his power. And here, I think it's very clear, you know, Jack Smith has alleged that Donald Trump was engaged in things that are outside the scope of a president's duties, like, you know, interfering with a state election, calling election officials and asking for more votes. The administration of state elections is a state function. It is not a presidential function. And so I think that it seems to me very likely that Jack Smith will prevail on the case. The only real question is when, because in this case, truly, justice delayed could be justice denied.
And were the Supreme Court to agree with Donald Trump's assertion that any president, he says, you know, he should be, and former presidents should enjoy total immunity.
Yeah.
Were the Supreme Court to go along with that, I mean, that's basically saying we do have a king, don't we?
Yeah, it really is, Bill. And that is why I think it's just absurd, and that can't be the case. And even the example, you know, that one of the justices or one of the judges on the Intermediate Court of Appeals asked about, could the president order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his rival, you know, during the State of the Union address, which is a great hypothetical to really, you know, stretch it out to its boundaries. And Trump's lawyer said yes. So we know that can't be right. A president can't violate the law with impunity. There may be some ground for things, you know, in the same way we give qualified immunity to police officers and others when they are doing their jobs in good faith and make a mistake. That might be a basis for this. But when you've got a president reaching outside the scope of his duties to deliberately interfere with an election in which he is a candidate, I just don't see any way that falls within the scope of a president's duties. So I'm really confident that Jack Smith will prevail. There is no immunity for the alleged conduct in this indictment. But again, my biggest worry now is delay, that this decision may not come quickly enough for the trial to begin and a verdict to be returned before the election, though I remain a sliver of hope.
Given his known conflicts of interest, should Clarence Thomas be a vote in this case?
I don't think so, in my personal opinion.
There's nothing we can do about it, right? Or nothing,
no,
Robert,
no,
do about it?
Nope. The Supreme Court makes their own decisions about recusal. And, you know, there is a recusal provision for judges that says that judges should recuse themselves when their impartiality in a case could be fairly questioned. And it seems to me that in light of Clarence Thomas's wife's role in planning the January 6th rallies and other things, and her email or text messages with Mark Meadows, you know, talking about keep the faith and King of Kings and all these kinds of things. It seems that his impartiality could reasonably be questioned here. And so it would seem to be prudent for him to recuse. But no sign that he's doing that. He didn't do it on this 14th Amendment case, and no sign that he'll be doing it in the immunity case or any others that might arise as a result of it.
Yeah, so there we are. Okay, promise. Final question about Donald Trump's legal problems, but, you know, the Supreme Court is just one aspect of, as we know. We got the Manhattan case with election interference, Stormy Daniels, the Georgia case, election fraud, the Florida case on the documents, the D.C. case on January 6th. Looking at that, which one do you think is the most serious, the most likely to come to trial, and the most likely to result in a felony conviction for Donald Trump?
Yeah, the most likely to come to trial, I think, is the Manhattan DA's case that's got a trial date now of March 25th. Looks reasonably certain that that case is going to go. You know, you never know the likelihood of conviction. There are a lot of factors that play into that. We haven't seen all of the evidence, but it is a document-based case. And I always found document-based cases were the strongest because it didn't rely too much on witnesses who might be impeached by the other side, you know, shown to have a bias or a poor memory or something like that. When you have documents, it's sort of hard to get out from under it. Although Michael Cohen is a witness in this case, he's a convicted perjurer. So that always is an uphill climb. But I do think it's likely that case goes to trial. I think even a conviction is likely. I just don't know if that's one that's likely to result in any jail time for Donald Trump. I think the Georgia case and the Mar-a-Lago case seem to be on a slower track. Although strong, less likely to come to trial this year. I think the federal election interference case is the one that is the most important, and that if there is a conviction before the election, I think will be something that voters really have to reckon with. Even if it's not before the election, as long as Donald Trump isn't elected himself and able to dismiss the case, it's a really important case because it goes to the heart of our democracy. If someone is able to engage in fraud on the American people and violate people's voting rights and obstruct official proceedings to steal an election, then we've really lost our democratic process for selecting a president. So I think it's incredibly important that that case go forward, at least at some point, to endeavor to hold someone accountable. He gets a fair trial and a jury will decide whether he violated the law and whether those allegations are true.
So our guest again is Barbara McQuaid, legal analyst. You see her on MSNBC and NBC News. Her new book, Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. I said at the top, Barbara, one of the scariest books I've ever read, which means it's so good and so important that I think everybody read it. Let me start in terms of scary. I want to start with the cover. Not everybody has it in front of them, but the cover of your book shows a map of the United States with a white fist, you know, pouncing through it. What did you mean by that cover?
Yeah. So, you know, the idea is attack from within. In recent years, we have certainly been targeted by hostile foreign adversaries, mostly Russia, with disinformation. But the warning I'm really trying to sound is the use of disinformation from our own people, from political actors who are, you know, attacking America from within. And I believe at this moment, it is this far right authoritarian strain that does not like the direction they see America going in and are willing to use lies to achieve their proposed ends by any means necessary. And so that fist is supposed to be an authoritarian right fist busting through, attacking our country from within.
Yeah, reminded me, I kept thinking of Bobby Kennedy's book, The Enemy Within, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was talking about corruption and labor unions at the time. But this disinformation, why is it such a serious threat?
Well, I think there are two things going on right now that are converging that make it such a serious threat, Bill. One is technology, the ability to spread propaganda in an instant and reach millions of people. Propaganda has been around for centuries, and I talk about the history and how it's been used. And although the tactics haven't changed, the method for delivery has. And it has become so easy and so pervasive. Just today, I don't know if you saw these. I saw these artificial intelligence generated images of Donald Trump posing with African Americans, and they're designed to make it look like Donald Trump has a lot of support in the African American community. But if you look very closely, you'll see that some of them have three fingers or six fingers or other things because they're just generated. These pictures didn't happen, and so they're designed to fool people. And they're very effective for fooling people. So one is this idea of technology that is making it so easy for people to fool others. But I think the other is we live in incredibly polarized times. I know there have been other times in American history when we've been polarized, but this one's right up there. And part of it is there has been a deliberate strategy of both parties to push out toward the extremes of both sides, you know, for the right to go farther right and the left to go farther left. Gone are the days when they are competing over the moderate middle for swing voters. Instead, they're doubling down on their base and trying to encourage people to get out and vote. And the best way to do that is by inciting outrage. And so I think that's why we hear both parties inciting outrage. And that combination, I think, leads to this result where people are choosing tribe over truth. I'm willing to say anything because that other side is so bad. And I want my side to win. That I'm willing to go along with the con and say whatever it takes to support my side. And I think that is one of the things that is so disturbing about this moment.
And really, to be very clear, you are not talking about a future threat that we should be watching out for, right? You're talking about what's going on right now.
Yes. And in fact, I think in this election year, we should expect that there will be a lot of disinformation designed to confuse us, to anger us, to sow discord, and to suppress the vote. You know, already we heard these robocalls in New Hampshire with a voice that sounded like Joe Biden, generated by artificial intelligence, urging voters to stay home from the polls. I am sure we're going to see more of that, with whether it's artificial intelligence generated images or, you know, fake texting scams about, did you know you can vote by text now? You know, when you can't, just text your vote to this number and enjoy the convenience of voting from home. There's going to be all kinds of stuff like that. And so I think we need to brace ourselves. I know the Secretary of State of my state of Michigan, Jocelyn Benson, is already working hard to generate materials that provide accurate voting information and enlisting credible ambassadors to try to get out there and share the word with voters so that voters will not be duped into wasting their vote on election day.
Again, Barbara McQuaid, her book is Attack from Within. Barbara, we'll take a quick break here. When we come back, I want to ask you what really struck me is you're talking about the authoritarian playbook. I didn't realize to what extent Donald Trump is already engaging in the authoritarian playbook. Quick break, and we'll be right back. And today's podcast with Barbara McQuaid, brought to you by the Iron Workers Union, the good men and women of the Iron Workers. They're the backbone of the American labor movement, doing some of the most dangerous of all jobs. And you think of those so many iconic American structures like the Golden Gate Bridge or the Gateway Arch in St. Louis or the new One World Trade Center Tower, all the work of the Iron Workers under the leadership of their president, Eric Dean. You know, they say their motto is the sky is the limit, and boy, do they mean it. Check out their website at ironworkers.org. You'll be impressed by all the great work they're doing. We thank the Iron Workers for rebuilding America, and we thank them for their support, longtime support of the Bill Press Pod.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And we're back with today's podcast. Very lucky to be talking to Barbara McQuaid. She is a law professor at the University of Michigan, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. You see her on MSNBC and NBC News as a legal analyst and author of the new book, Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Just before the break, I mentioned, Barbara, you break down the authoritarian playbook. Just some of the tactics you mentioned, right? Stressing emotion over reason, exploiting divisions, undermining critics, dismantling public institutions, stoking violence, painting the leader as a Superman. That's Donald Trump.
I know. Isn't it chilling? It's so chilling to read these tactics of Hitler and Mussolini and others.
Yeah.
And you look at it and think, oh my gosh, that's exactly what he's done. You know, this portraying the leader as Superman. You know, think about those weird trading cards with Donald Trump, like, you know, in a superhero cape and things like that. Think about how often he references himself coming down that golden escalator, you know, as if descending from the heavens to come down to earth to lead us mere mortals, saying things like, only I can fix it. It's really similar to some of the things that we hear from others. You know, another undermining critics. So, you know, laying this groundwork, even in advance of your own term in office, calling the press the enemy of the people, referring to the career civil service as the deep state, criticizing protesters, you know, anybody who might be a critic of you, to first undermine them so that when that inevitable criticism comes, you've already turned your supporters against them so that they're just jeering. You know, Hitler referred to the press in Nazi Germany as the Lügenpresse, which is German for lying press. so similar to what we hear from Donald Trump with enemy of the people. So yeah,
fake news.
Exactly. I mean, right. The same thing. So, and then, you know, when you talk about fake news, that is a tactic that Vladimir Putin uses, which is when there is fake news, as there is, then you can call everything fake news that you don't like. And it's sometimes referred to as the liar's dividend. I can benefit from this atmosphere where there is what they call in Russia the fog of unknowability. Nobody knows what the truth is anymore. So if there's something, some bad fact that comes out against me, I can just say, well, that's fake news. You don't have to believe that. It's really disturbing.
There are a couple of other elements of this that struck me. One is preaching decline, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that you hear that all the time. I mean, our economy is in pretty good shape, right? But all you hear from Fox News and Donald Trump is how the economy is in the toilet, right? And it's worse than it's ever been, and it was best than it ever was under Donald Trump. They have to run America down, basically, right, in order to make a case for the strong man to come back and fix it.
Absolutely. And this is another tactic used by authoritarians throughout history, is to talk about we're a nation in decline. You know, Donald Trump referred to it as American carnage. Hitler did this to Germany after World War One. You know, the whole world's laughing at us. We're in a terrible state. And then also to scapegoat other people. Let me tell you whose fault it is. It's not your fault. It's not the fault of, you know, corporate tax cuts and other things that have created the greatest wealth disparity in this country since World War II. It's not that. It's these other bad people. It's the immigrants. It's the LGBTQ community. Those are the people who are making life in America bad. And so how do we fix this? Well, we might need to throw out some of the traditional rules. We might need to decide the ends justify the means. You know, Hitler threw out their own constitution to be able to achieve what he wanted to achieve, and the people were willing to go along with it. Donald Trump has even posted on social media that we need to go to great lengths when an election has been stolen, even if it means suspending the constitution. So I think the parallels are really eerie.
Even if it means violence, right?
Yes. Well, and that's the other thing, is normalizing violence. You mentioned that as one of these things in the authoritarian playbook, is to normalize it. You know, in the streets of Germany, Jews would be forced to scrub the streets and others would gather around and jeer, because it was all part of the effort to make the public come to see them as less than human. And so we see this when, you know, Donald Trump points out the media in the back row at his rallies and say, see these people back there, they hate America and they don't want you to know the truth. Or talking about, you know, immigrants as vermin, poisoning the blood of America, and speaking languages nobody knows, all of these kinds of things. That is what makes people feel like they're not just entitled to engage in violence, but almost required to. That to take back our country in the vision that Donald Trump portrays, then any means is necessary, including violence. As we saw on January 6th, you know, we have a lot of disputes in this country, but the way we resolve them is in courts. Donald Trump lost all of his court battles, and so he encouraged people to come and use violence and force to stop the certification of the election for his opponent.
And until you mentioned it, I hadn't connected holding all the big rallies. That's another thing that authoritarians throughout history have done. And you've cited him a few times. I mean, a lot of people are critical when anybody brings Hitler into an argument. But in this case, the comparisons to Hitler and to other authoritarians, Stalin, et cetera, in history are really, they're legitimate, aren't they? I mean, they're right on.
Yeah, I think so. You know, sometimes, you know, people will be very vitriolic and try to make a comparison to something, you know, so awful like the Holocaust or, you know, slavery or something like that. That just can't possibly equate to the horrors of those two eras of history. But what I'm talking about are the tactics. And if you look at the tactics of Hitler and what he wrote in Mein Kampf, you see it happening today. You know, a couple things he wrote about in Mein Kampf were about the importance of repeating messages over and over and over, especially if you can have a catchy little phrase like stop the steal or lock her up or drain the swamp. He also talked about going big, that most of us believe little white lies because we all tell them, but it would never occur to us to have the audacity to tell a lie about something of great significance, and we project onto others that same moral compass. And so for that reason, ironically, the bigger the lie, the more likely it is to be believed. And, you know, for Hitler, it was about the Jewish people being part of some great replacement and cabal who are the source of all evil. For Trump, it is a stolen election. And because it is so big and because it is repeated, people believe it. And I hope that one of the things my book will do is to help people recognize these tactics so that we can defeat them and not be manipulated by them.
Well, that gets to what I think is the strongest part of your book, which is the last couple of chapters, you talk about fixing it. I mean, you assert, right, that we can escape, I love your phrase, death by disinformation, right? Mm-hmm. That we can escape death by disinformation. But it's up to us, isn't it? And do you really believe technology being what it is, that we can get out of the disinformation age maybe and back into the age of truth?
I do. I think that there are a number of things we can do. Some of them require legislative policymaking, some regulation on social media. I don't think we have to go so far as to remove the Section 230 immunity that social media sites enjoy, but I think there are things we can do to cause them to disclose the way they use algorithms to generate outrage, or the way they micro-target groups to send certain targeted messages to us to manipulate us, or to disclose the sources of political ads, who's paying for those things. I think some of those things could go a long way toward helping us to see behind the curtain. And there are also some technological ways of detecting our artificial intelligence generated images online. There's a researcher at the University of Michigan Dearborn who is creating artificial intelligence to investigate whether images have been created by artificial intelligence, and it can detect fakes. So there may be some tools out there that can help us to detect the fakes. But I think mostly we need to educate ourselves to become more media literate. We can certainly teach it in our schools. We can teach it to adults. And all of us have a responsibility to, rather than being an unwitting dupe and passing on false information, you know, spend a moment reading a story, not just the headline, looking for a second source, looking at data that tends to support a statistical conclusion, looking at, you know, causation versus correlation, and really trying to understand facts before we pass them along to others. And then finally, Bill, I think one of the things we have to do is we have to accept truth, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we have to avoid this, you know, sort of either or situation where there's only two sides to every issue and we demand political purity. Compromise is the way to achieve goals in this country. And I think we need to get back to that. And we can only do that if we are willing to engage in truth, to concede points when they don't support our side, and to not go along with the con just to advance our own political or personal or profit agenda.
Yeah, you really underscore the importance of that and the possibility of that by talking about your experience in Ireland, right?
Yes.
When you were there, where they were debating whether or not abortion should be the law of the land.
Yeah, right? It was such an interesting time. We happened to be in Ireland a few years ago when there was a ballot referendum as to whether to permit abortion in Ireland, which is a Catholic country, and it had been prohibited for, you know, its entire history. And I expected the debate to be raging, you know, that I could only imagine what that would be like in the United States if there was a national referendum on abortion. And instead, what I found was people on street corners passing out literature. Some were on the no side, some were on the yes side. And whenever you approached, they politely asked, would you like to learn more about the issue? And they might hand you a pamphlet or a button. And no one was yelling. No one was browbeating. Everybody was speaking in such civil and polite tones. And I think that is, and of course it passed by overwhelming margin so that abortion became legal despite this long history. And I think that it was a really great example of how we really need to understand that unity is what matters most. Working together to solve problems is what matters most. And not pounding on each other to get our way. And I just thought that seeing that come alive in Ireland was an eye-opening experience that it can happen.
Well, yeah, or not tearing down the Capitol when they lost. What do you see is the role of the media in all of this? Because certainly, again, authoritarian playbook is to attack the media to and the veracity, if you will, of the media. But is the media's role to just roll with it or fight back?
Yeah, I think it's really tough, and I don't think the media has quite figured this out yet.
You're right about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have some like Fox News, which paid more than $700 million in a defamation suit to Dominion voting systems for, as we know now from emails and text messages that got revealed during the discovery phase of that case, fully knowing that the election was not stolen. Sean Hannity saying, "I never believed it for a minute," and yet airing all of this false information about how Dominion voting systems flipped votes from Trump to Biden. You know, that's so there's some who are absolutely stoking it, and shame on them. I don't know, though, that Fox got the message, but one hopes that a large defamation payout could make a difference. But I think other outlets of good faith just aren't quite sure how you go about this, because on the one hand, if you give coverage to lies, then you are helping to propagate them, because people, you know, don't pay attention to 100% of what is written or what is heard, and they just kind of hear something stolen election, so it might give oxygen to that. On the other hand, I know sometimes some news outlets are just declining to show Trump's rallies altogether because they don't want to give him oxygen for lies. But then the people are left with, you know, not knowing what he's saying, not seeing it with analysis, only seeing the raw footage or his own spin on it. And maybe people are not, you know, getting the kind of context or analysis they need for these things. So I don't know what is the right way to do this. I do think it's important to fact check. And when there are falsehoods stated, to say so. I think the press just has never dealt with anybody like Donald Trump before and is still trying to figure out how you do that. You know, most politicians may have spin, they may have a particular policy view, but this idea of just outright lying and making stuff up is so new that I think this tradition of sharing both sides of an issue just doesn't translate well when one side is willing to craft complete fabrication. So I don't know the answer there, but I think the media is still working through that.
Boy, they are. On NBC News Sunday night, I saw they were covering some comments that Donald Trump had made at some rally. And the reporter said, and then the president, the former president, just proceeded to repeat some of the big lies that some of the lies he's already told, but then they played Trump repeating the lies. And I was wondering, you know, I guess maybe, but some people are going to hear him say that and still believe it. So, yeah, we're still trying to figure that out for sure. But anyhow, death by disinformation, Barbara, what a great public service you have done in publishing this book. Again, your game plan as to how to fix it is very detailed, a very detailed outline that what you think the Congress ought to do, state governments ought to do, and what we the people ought to do too. And I think that's so, so important, as well as laying out what the threat really is. The book, again, friends, is Attack from Within. There'll be a link in the episode notes to today's podcast for you to get your own copy of the book, which I strongly encourage. It'll give you hope that we can work together and fix it and get back to an age of truth and get out of the age of disinformation. Barbara McQuaid, thank you for all the great work you do, and thank you for joining us on the Bill Press Pod.
Thank you, Bill.
And that's it for today's podcast with Barbara McQuaid. Again, her book, Attack from Within. Read it. You'll be disheartened and then impressed by the fact that, yeah, it may be bad now, but we can get back on track. And Barbara McQuaid lays out the path to do so. And again, there'll be a link in the episode notes to today's podcast to get your copy of Attack from Within. And now, what a big week ahead of a Super Tuesday. And then the State of the Union, and then whether or not the government's going to stay open after March 8th. All of that we'll be talking about on the roundtable on Friday morning. So have a great week, but don't forget to come back on Friday morning where we'll wrap up all the big news of this week on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.